Welcome to the Georgia Today podcast from GPB News. Today is Wednesday, March 13th. I'm Peter Biello. On today's episode, a judge overseeing Georgia's 2020 election interference case dismisses some of the charges. Georgia puts President Biden over the top in delegates needed to secure his party's nomination, and we'll talk to the Georgia author of a new novel that examines the divide between urban and rural life. These stories and more are coming up on this edition of Georgia Today. The judge overseeing Georgia's 2020 election interference case has dismissed some of the charges in the state's sprawling prosecution. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee ordered six counts removed today from the indictment, including three against former President Donald Trump. McAfee said the courts didn't allege sufficient detail about the violations. Georgia State University law professor Anthony Michael Kreiss says that means Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis could seek a new indictment on the thrown-out charges.
I think it's a hiccup for the DA, but it's nothing that she can't remedy fairly quickly if she gets a couple of constitutional law experts on her team to redraft these indictments.
One of the dismissed charges stems from a phone call Trump made to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger after the election. Other charges, including 10 facing Trump, were left in place. President Joe Biden secured the delegates he needed for the Democratic Party's nomination after winning the Georgia Democratic primary yesterday. Former President Donald Trump won Georgia's Republican primary and secured the delegates he needed for his party's nomination after also winning primaries in Mississippi and Washington. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said about 11% of registered voters voted in the primary, with more than 700,000 voters casting ballots. A Senate committee passed a bill that would ban puberty blockers for transgender minors but allow exceptions for children using the blockers for other reasons. GPB's Sarah Callis has the latest.
House Bill 1170 passed the House as a bill aiming to place opioid antagonists in more state buildings. Senators added an amendment in committee that would ban puberty blockers for those children receiving gender-affirming care. Senator Ben Watson, who carried the bill in the Senate, said the House sponsor Lee Hawkins agreed to the change.
But to make irreversible changes in potential side effects and deleterious problems relating to the puberty blockers outweighs any potential benefit.
Senator Kim Jackson does not support the amendment to HB 1170.
It was a great bill that really could have saved lots of Georgians. And now we've attached another bill that undoubtedly will hurt children.
HB 1170 has to pass the full Senate and go back to the House before it reaches Governor Kemp's desk. For GPB News, I'm Sarah Callis at the State Capitol.
The brother of the man accused of killing Georgia nursing student Lakin Riley has been indicted. Diego Ibarra faces one felony count stemming from his alleged possession of a counterfeit immigration document. That's according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Middle District of Georgia. Prosecutors say Ibarra presented a fake permanent foreign resident ID card during questioning by Athens law enforcement about Riley's death. If convicted, Diego Ibarra could face up to a decade in prison. His brother, Jose Ibarra, is currently jailed without bond, charged with Riley's murder. Black business leaders gathered in Atlanta this week to unveil the Black Wall Street ticker. It's a way to track spending within the black community. GPB's Amanda Andrews has more.
The digital tracker is an effort by the spending platform Friends of the Movement to bring economic justice to the black community. To use it, people create an account called a voter wallet where they can access a database of businesses to support. The ticker tracks money spent by businesses, corporations, and individuals in real time. CEO Charles Walker Jr. says it will hold organizations accountable who claim to support diverse businesses.
There was a 7,000% increase in minority business searches after George Floyd. There was a 98% decrease a month after. Why do we start off strong and get tired very quickly? The technology exists. There are no more excuses.
The ticker is available online. For GPB News, I'm Amanda Andrews.
The world's largest wood pellet manufacturer, with the plant in Waycross and a marine terminal in Savannah, has declared bankruptcy. Maryland-based Enviva said yesterday it's entered a restructuring agreement to reduce its debt by about $1 billion. Environmental groups hailed the announcement after long accusing the company of profiting from excessive carbon emissions and pollution. Enviva says the agreement will help the company position itself for long-term success. Cases of COVID-19 have declined significantly as winter moves into spring. State epidemiologist Dr. Sherry Drenzik told members of the State Board of Public Health yesterday the vast majority of patients hospitalized with the virus had not been vaccinated. Yesterday marked the fourth anniversary of the first reported death from COVID-19 in Georgia. Drenzik says the state is in a remarkably different place from back then.
80% of the population had no immunity in January 2021. And 3 years later, we've got almost everyone, you know, 98% of the population does have immunity against COVID.
Drenzik says immunity doesn't stop infection but reduces severity of symptoms. She also reported influenza cases peaked in January, while RSV cases peaked in October. Macon Bibb County opened a new city-built 12,000-seat amphitheater last night. The show was a test run for the venue officially opening later this year. An audience of mostly city employees and invited guests attended the first concert. GPB's Grant Blankenship spoke during the soundcheck to one performer, Charles Davis, of the Macon Music Review.
Mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2, check, love.
The Macon Music Review, it is it has been described, a preservation band for Macon music. We perform every Wednesday night at Grant's Lounge at 8 o'clock, like I said, Otis Redding, Little Richard, James Brown, the Allman Brothers, and all of the music that was influenced here in Macon, Georgia. For what this amphitheater is going to become and what it's going to mean to the community, the fact that Macon artists are the first ones to perform on it means something. You'll have a ton of great artists that are going to come through here, but it will always be said that the first people to ever play at the Atrium Health Amphitheater were Macon artists, so it's a big thing.
That was Charles Davis of the Macon Music Review before the first concert at the new Atrium Health Amphitheater in Macon. And Atlanta's Fox Theater is rebranding and expanding its grant program to preserve community theaters across the state. Theater officials said yesterday the Fox Theater Institute is now Fox Gives. It also announced its largest ever multi-year donation, $500,000 to the Hart Community Theater in Northeast Georgia's Hart County. Imagine you look up at the sky and you see a giant object hurtling toward Earth. Collision is inevitable, and you assume human civilization will soon go the way of the dinosaurs. But what hits Earth is not a meteor, but a body of a giant alien made of crystals. And it doesn't slam into Earth, but it sets down softly in a small Nebraska town. Now imagine that you're the local sheriff of that town, and suddenly that town is not so sleepy anymore. That's the premise of the new novel, Godfall, by Atlanta author Van Jensen, who joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is, I wouldn't say a sci-fi novel, but it's got elements of sci-fi. It's not a purely whodunit, though it's got a murder mystery. And it's not necessarily a romance, although there is some romance in it. So it encompasses a lot. But let's start with that central premise, the giant alien made of crystals falling out of the sky, landing softly in Nebraska. How did you come up with that premise?
I kind of find ideas anywhere. So I try to I read a lot of nonfiction. I read the news. You know, I try to be out in the world experiencing life. Right. And then sometimes stuff just appears. And this was one of those. I think I was, half asleep. And it was just this vision of a giant alien thing landing in western Nebraska. And western Nebraska is where I grew up. So, of course, there's always a tether there. But this particular thing about it that I think made it so evocative, this vision, is that Nebraska is the flattest place on Earth.
Good place for a giant alien to land.
Right, yeah. Right. A big landing zone. But what I saw in my mind's eye is this unbroken horizon that all of a sudden has this very artificial, very unnatural, very frightening mountain range. And the plot, the story of it is just really was me thought experimenting, what would happen? Where would this go? And really what I think gave me the passion to keep going is it's very much based on my hometown and where I grew up and the experience of this place. And so I hadn't written about that place before.
The town in this book, Little Springs, Nebraska, because this alien lands there, changes tremendously. I mean, we jump forward months after the alien lands, and there are all sorts of newcomers here. And the sheriff, your main focus of this book, David, Sheriff David, he starts to see people as people who've been here forever, and then the newcomers, right?
Right.
And that becomes kind of a divide in his head that creates the central theme here of otherness, right? And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why that theme was important for you in this book.
I'm a product of a small town. I love rural America. At the same time, I've lived in cities for effectively all of my adult life, and I love cities. But we're at a time, I think, in this country where those two sides do not interact with each other. Or if they do, it's just like insults hurled each way. Like, and I think there's a ton of misunderstanding, but mostly there's just no interaction. And so I just thought, wouldn't it be fascinating to write a book that's a murder mystery, but is also this like forced integration of urban and rural life, like these people having to figure out how to talk to each other, like how to, because I mean, life is hard. Like there are disagreements, but you can't do anything about that stuff unless you actually talk to each other.
You've worn many hats over the years. You were a crime reporter at one point in your career. It shouldn't be terribly surprising, I think, that a former crime reporter would write about a law enforcement official. Were you thinking of folks in law enforcement that you met along the way, or were there other influences from your crime reporting days in writing this book?
The biggest help, I think, in having done journalism is just like people always ask me how to get over writer's block. And I'm like, why? I don't know. I just write. Like, I just sit down and do it. And that's the journalism training, is like, you either write or you don't have a job anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'm very grateful for that experience. But relating to crime specifically, it was a very trying experience. I was in Little Rock, Arkansas. Little Rock is a shockingly violent city, to the point that there have been documentaries about how violent it is. So it was a really intense period of my life. It was not a job that I love because, you know, it's like my best day as a reporter is someone else's worst day.
Which is something the reporter in this book says about
right.
her job.
Right. It's you know, like something horrific happens and you get this amazing front page story and you feel great about, oh, I got on the front page, and you're like, oh yeah, but like two people died. But with the police, you know, I definitely experienced like there are great police. There are people who really care, who really try hard, who are super invested in the community, who want to be good people. There are struggles against just like the system that they work within. And there are also bad cops, and they do incredible amounts of damage. And so I got to see all of that. And I think really it's just knowing the way that police actually work. Like, I always want my writing to be believable and, you know, it's realistic enough. Like, again, this is a book with a giant dead alien. So
that almost makes it more important for everything else to be exactly realistic.
Yeah. So that was my goal. And, you know, so David's character, more than anything, is based on my dad. And my dad, he, you know, not a cop. He's a dentist. He retired as a dentist. From childhood, his dream, and he grew up in the same town, his dream was to be the dentist in this town. Mm-hmm. And then he grew up and he did exactly that. And like, he loves this town. Like, he wants it. I mean, his family has been part of it forever. He wants it to continue to be the thing that it is. And he does, you know, just all these incredible things all the time to enrich the community around him. And so that was really the seed of like, anytime I was like, oh, what, like, how would David look at this? It's like, okay, here's what my dad would do.
Godfall is turning into a TV show.
It is.
It's in the process. Can you tell us about what that's like, how you think this book is going to translate into a TV show?
Yeah. I mean, it's been very shocking and in the best way. And
because Ron Howard is
directing it.
Wow.
Which is insane. Like, objectively insane. I mean, this is a small press book, right? The first agent that I gave it to, literary agent, just never read it. And so, you know, like it's lived many lives and it's taken a long time to get out. And I mean, I have someone that I work with in LA who wanted to send it out to people, and I had no expectation. I mean, I've done that dance, right?
Mm.
And then all of a sudden it became this thing to where there are like multiple articles in the Hollywood trades about me and about the book, which is just mind blowing.
Have you heard anything about what Ron Howard saw in this story that he wanted to bring to a visual audience?
he saw all the stuff that I've talked about already, the stuff that I love about the book, the stuff that made me want to write the book. He said he always wanted to do sci-fi and hasn't had the chance to do that. He's always wanted to do TV and hasn't effectively done any TV. And then he just said, you know, I love that it exists in this rural American space in such a genuine way. And we don't see that on TV and in films. And also, like, he loved that it has a lot of heart. Like, even though there's dark stuff that happens, I hope that it comes across that way. But I think it's a very hopeful book.
Well, Van Jensen, thank you so much for speaking with me about your book. This is wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Love it.
And you can find a link to the video of my extended chat with Van Jensen at gpb.org/news. And that's all we've got for this edition of Georgia Today. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you want to learn more about any of these stories, visit gpb.org/news. And if you haven't subscribed to this podcast yet, I highly recommend it. We'll be back in your podcast feed tomorrow if you do, with all the top stories from Georgia. And if you've got feedback or know of a top story, let us know by email. The address is georgiatoday@gpb.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.